The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy
with Nissan
on News Talk.
It is 6 o'clock. That means it's time for the soapbox. Today, taking that mantle is Nolene Blackwell, human rights lawyer, consultant, and online safety coordinator with the Children's Rights Alliance. Nolene, you are very welcome.
Thank you, Anton.
So you're going to look at the so-called third sector, the community and voluntary sector, otherwise known as NGOs, which have been getting somewhat of a lot of stick recently.
Yeah, or it's kind of an air of a way in which they're being considered that makes me a little bit worried about it. So that whole area of NGOs, non-governmental organisations, voluntary organisations, first of all, it's very hard to know sometimes what to call them because people have different names for them along the way. But ultimately, what they provide all of these organisations together, there are about 11,500 charities. There's about 20,000 other not-for-profit organisations, all of them 30,000 organisations making a massive improvement because the one thing they have in common is they want to do good in the public interest. That's the purpose of each of those organisations. Each of them tends to have all charities have to have a constitution that says if they go bust, any money they have can't go to the members. It has to go somewhere else. If they get registered as a charity, they have governance rules with the charity's inspectors.
So now, the money thing, though, Nolene, this, of course, is a bit of an issue because people would say, well, look, if you want to be a charity and act out of altruistic dedication to the community, have at it.
Absolutely.
But a lot of the 30,000 do so on the state dime.
They do. And they are doing it as well. They're getting money from other places as well. So for a long time, I worked in private practice. But for a long time, I've worked paid in an organisation. I don't have that trust fund, no more than anybody else, that would allow me to do it for nothing. But people really do have a problem with money going to people, which isn't going directly towards services. So the money is a problem. But if you look at it this way, actually, it is the state that has the responsibility to ensure health, education, housing, social welfare, protection of children, protection from online harm. The state is doing all of these things. They also have the responsibility in relation to helping the survivors of domestic and sexual violence. In all of these cases, the state has that obligation and people have the right to expect it. But what the state can do is it can outsource that work to trained, experienced individuals, people who are not in it for the building up a big organisation, people who are in it because they want to be part of this organisation that advances the public good. So the state has a duty. It pays the community and voluntary sector. Sometimes, at the same time, it will pay a commercial company. It always has to pay the commercial company more because the state has traditionally been able to get away with paying the community and voluntary sector less now, because they'll make the money somewhere else.
Let me put it to you that they get, for the dime that they give to the community and voluntary sector, they get delivery of service, but they get two additional things. They buy off criticism and they buy in advocacy.
Who buys off? The state.
The state. The state buys off those who might otherwise be in criticism of them.
Yeah.
And it buys advocacy from those entities with taxpayers' money.
It does. And that's exactly what it's looking for. Surely it wants not to be criticised for not providing the services. So if the voluntary organisation, the NGO, is providing them at least as good as the state could, even if it gave them directly, and if at the same time it is getting intelligence from people who are working on the ground with some of the most vulnerable people in our society, they need that as well. In fact, it's part of the problem that I have seen emerging at the moment is that nobody seems to mind where civil society, this third sector, does the work, provides the services. What they mind is when they express their opinion.
Whereas, but what I'm suggesting to you, Nolene, is that by the state giving money to the NGOs, there is a view that in so doing, they are blunting any criticism they would otherwise receive them. You take an organisation that might be a firebrand of criticism against the state and you say, tell you what, we'll give you 30% of your funding, and suddenly you are vastly economically disincentivised from opening your mouth in public.
And that is a problem that the state has to deal with, and it's part of my worry as well. Because the state should be saying, we'll give you the 30% because that's what it costs to produce the service, or indeed we'll give you all of what it costs to produce that service. Miracles may still happen, but they should also, and this is where the state falls down sometimes, is where it considers a valid criticism of it or a suggestion as to how things could be done better or otherwise. It considers that as criticism which cannot come from a funded entity. And there are actually some organisations bound by their contract with the state not to speak about those kind of things. The state would do much, much better to take a view that these organisations doing this work on the ground, if they're doing it properly, that's what they're getting paid for. If the state can also get intelligence and information about what the remaining gaps are, about what's not happening correctly, the state wins. A mature democracy allows people to give it the sort of information that it needs.
Now, should the two relationships not be severed? Should the state not say, well, if we are responsible, let us say, for something like homeless care provision,
yes,
we will do that directly through an arm of the state. If a charity wishes to do it for a charitable reason, let them at it independently. But let's not muddy the waters by providing state service through quasi-charitable organisations.
I don't see it like that at all. Like in my last role when I was with Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, I always thought we were much better provisioned and much more experienced to deal with those who had experienced sexual violence than sending them into a large general hospital and to a room in there to get their health services and to have no services in relation to their right to justice as well along the way. So we were the right people to do that job. It's not maybe the way, if you were starting from nowhere, you probably wouldn't start here, but your Citizens Information Service, your rape crisis centres, your domestic violence and shelters and services have all grown up from a community. They grew up because a community knew what was happening there. Today, community cafes are happening in villages all around the country, bringing in people who have had to flee here from war and the rest of it, arranging for inclusion in a way that the state could never do, will never be able to do. Maybe I always said as well that if the state provided a better service than we could provide in the Rape Crisis Centre, then well and good. They could not and they would not, because we were doing a better job and we were doing it more cheaply than the state ever could. But it did not stop. It did not stop the state in the case of domestic and sexual violence deciding they were better to co-design the current strategy to end domestic and sexual violence. And that has worked much better than them saying we were not allowed to talk.
Let me ask you one of the things that has become an issue in the light of the recent referendums,
yes,
which is the advocacy role of the NGOs. One of the criticisms that people have been putting is that the state is now in a position where it can use the NGOs, whether it does this consciously or subconsciously, it can use the NGOs that it funds to act as amplifying mouthpieces for state policy and therefore use the taxpayers' money to convince the taxpayers of government policy.
Yes. I saw that and it came as near to misinformation as anything I've ever seen, to be perfectly honest. I saw it at the level of even national politicians who were making those kind of leaps of logic which made no sense. The state funds organisations to do work that it should be doing itself, and that if it's not doing that research, if it's not providing that service, then someone else has to do it. And it goes to, and very often on foot of a tender, it will go to a particular organisation. What happened in the referendum struck me as something that makes me want to talk about this right now. It was where it was suggested that organisations that were getting state funding were actually getting that state funding to advocate for a position in the referendum. Whereas those organisations already had their opinion, they had their position, they had their funding. And this
now, let me put it to you, to some extent there is an element of chicken and egg in this.
Yeah.
If I am funding a group of NGOs,
yes,
and I know, okay, I have given them X million, and of that X million, they have hired somebody at a high level to be an active public advocate for their policy. And I know that they are a yes in this referendum that I am offering them. And I know if somebody from my party gives them a nudge and says, lads, will you go out and proselytise on behalf of this? I'm buying a fairly effective service in terms of influencing public policy, haven't I?
But if you, yes, I suppose you are, if that's the way you look at it. But if you say, I know that this organisation has this opinion because they've been telling me for years they have this opinion. They've been telling me for years they're unhappy about this particular provision in a law or a constitution or something. And then if the organisation then says, actually, we want this change to happen, that is not... That's not a cynical exercise. That's a rational decision by an organisation to say it is better than what was there. It is what we have been aiming for. And very likely it was the organisations highlighting those issues in the first place that put the impetus there to make these changes
now, that
or any
to
other
the,
changes.
The second concern that people may raise, which is one where you say, well, OK, the old, was it the Roosevelt line of I agree with you, now go out and put pressure on me. The capacity for state money to be used to deliver on an NGO's own objective. You meet with the parliamentarian, you win them over, and then you can use state cash to pressure them into a change of policy.
You can't pressure the politicians into a change of policy. You can produce reasonable arguments.
You can make a lot of noise if you
research.
Have enough staff.
Most money, in fact, most money, given by this, all money given by the state is what's called restricted money. It is given for a particular purpose. It's given for a piece of research. It's given for the delivery of a service. It is not given. In fact, more should be given to allow for thinking time, to allow for people to deal with all of the infrastructural things they have to do. But that's a different argument. I'll come back to you another day on that. But just in relation to this, it's the advocacy that is done by NGOs to go back to base is done to advance the public good, to protect human rights, to ensure that we have a better society overall. That's what civil society is about. Civil society may be critical of government at one stage. It may, and this to me makes sense as well and is respectful, that if they are listened to, if they're understood, and if change is to happen in law or in policy, then civil society can say as well, we approve, we agree that that change should happen.
Final thing then, I get the sense, and going back to what you said about misinformation, I get the sense, and maybe I'm reading too much into it, but that you have a concern about the way the NGOs have been portrayed in recent weeks. If so, what's the counterview? How should they be seen?
Well, I think what we have to go back to is to recognise that for most of us, we spend a lot of our time in the private space where we go around doing our daily business and we get on with our lives and we have our jobs and we, you know, mind our children, we wash our cars. Sometimes we take up the weeds in the garden, all of that
mind
kind
the
of
car,
thing.
Wash the children, whatever.
Yeah,
it may be.
Whatever. Yes. All of that. And then there is the public space, which is easily visible, the politicians, the public service. And then we have this link between the two. We have for society does all of the things it has to do for its own person, for its own family, and then they do more because they go out, they join a board, they're a volunteer when they do that. They go out and they say, my job is going to be for a not-for-profit organisation. I'm never going to be as rich and wealthy as I would be if I do something else. They campaign for something. They've gone through some experience where they know the service was not there that they needed along the way. We should value that link we have between the public space and the private space, which is this third space, this third sector. We should recognise that actually we need them, and that all over Europe, civil society is being shut down and dissed. And when we lose it, we will lose a big part of our democracy.
Nolene, thank you so much. Nolene Blackwell, human rights lawyer, consultant and online safety coordinator with the Children's Rights Alliance.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With Nissan.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.